everybody. Happy New Year. This is Adam Sharkoff, the host of Film Wax Radio. It's a chat show with indie film luminaries. Is that corny? Anyway, you need to just have some way to describe your show in as few words as possible. And that's kind of what I just decided to... So I hope everybody had a happy New Year. And as I record this, it is the 4th of January, 2018. Outside, there's a bit of a blizzard, I guess. I don't know. It's snowing. They used to just call it snowing. Now everything is a weather incident or a weather event. I don't know. It does make a lot of sense to me. Nevertheless, it is snowing. It is chilly out, and it is winter. So there you go. You know, over the holidays, I just got into wanting to watch old Humphrey Bogart movies. I should mention a couple things. I just finished reading a book about Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart and their friendship, and it's called Hank and Jim. And the author, Scott Eyman, I believe that's the way he's pronounced his name, E-Y-M-A-N, is coming on the podcast. So I read that, and then I read this book on Billy Wilder called On Sunset Boulevard. And it's by an author named Ed Seacoff, who's a New Yorker and who is also going to be on the podcast eventually. So I just, after reading these books, I just started to get the urge to start immersing myself in watching some of these old movies from, you know, mostly from the 40s. And so I've been doing that, and I watched a number of Bogart movies that I have never seen before. So, you know, it wasn't going back to The Maltese Falcon and Casablanca. I actually watched a number, including All Through the Night, which I had never seen before, The Big Shot, Knock on Any Door, Conflict. So I saw like these four Bogart movies in a row. I was just, not the same day, but within like a couple of days. And then I started watching some Billy Wilder movies too. One was a movie he wrote because, you know, he started as a screenwriter primarily. And his co-writing partner was a guy named Charles Brackett. And the two of them were a very famous Hollywood screenwriting team, you know. And they wrote this one film. It's a screwball comedy with Gary Cooper and Barbara Stanwyck called Ball of Fire. So I watched that finally. And then I've been watching a number of Billy Wilder directed movies that I've never seen before, which, you know, I'm surprised I'm at the age I'm at, and I hadn't actually taken care of this and watched these yet. But so I watched A Foreign Affair, and then I'm watching right now, actually, Five Graves to Cairo, which is fantastic. A Foreign Affair is great. I love Jean Arthur. There's a couple of women from the screwball comedy era that I just love, you know. And, you know, you think back and you say, okay, Katharine Hepburn was certainly one. And Carol Lombard. Yeah, that's right. Carol Lombard. Anyway, so, but there are so many others, you know, there's Myrna Loy and there's Jean Arthur and Barbara Stanwyck, you know. And, you know, Barbara Stanwyck, she was like the great femme fatale in a number of film noirs. She's certainly best known for that. But she also could do some great screwball comedies. And she was lovely, lovely. I'm at that age where now I can go and I can appreciate these women who have all died of old age, you know, but still I look back and I'm thinking, man, how cute were these women? I can understand why they were cast in so many movies, you know, and opposite all those great actors of the day. Anyhow, so I just wanted to share that. I've been watching these movies. I'm going to watch a bunch more since I'm snowed in today. I think I'll try to watch as many of these films and catch up on. So I can, when I bring on these authors, I can talk to them about it. But I mean, the Bogart was just for me because, you know, I love Bogart. Who doesn't love Bogart? But there's so many holes in my experience seeing these films. I didn't realize just how many movies this guy made, and you know how many of them are so great. I mean, they're all flawed in some manner or other, but they're quite forgivable flaws considering the entertainment value. So I recommend it if it's something, you know, Turner Classic Movies, they're mostly on there, so you can certainly indulge, but I'm just enjoying myself. Okay, this is, what are we up to here? First episode of the new year. We're on episode number 454. This guy is an illustrator named Tony Stella. He's based in Berlin, actually, even though he's from Italy. He spends his time mostly in Germany, but he goes back and forth. And if you have a chance to see his work, he's not only an incredible illustrator, of wonderful movie posters and movie art. I mean, you got to see what this guy does. He puts it all up on Instagram and Twitter. And please do check him out. And he's an incredible movie buff. Like nobody, one of the very most incredible movie buffs of anybody I've ever met. So I'm going to talk to him. We're going to bring him on right now. And again, his name is Tony Stella. Please go to his website. It's antoniostella.tumblr.com. antoniostella.tumblr. That's T-U-M-B-L-R for those who are not familiar with tumblr.com. And check out this man's work. He, let's see, I'm just on there now, and at the very top is his, oh, it's so beautiful. And I should mention, he does these by hand. He's an incredible artist. He has Black Panther, which is coming out. It's not even out. And then he mostly does posters from the past. Like right under that is Lino Ventura and Jean-Paul Belmondo in Classe to Risque, which was a Claude Sauté film. And then Pumping Iron. There's Schwarzenegger, Predator. A bunch of just one thing after. I'm just going down. He has a poster of Rocky. It's beautiful. Guy does such incredible work. Anyway, check it out. He's a lot of fun. And then after that, I think we'll just skip the outro. We'll be back in a week with another episode of the podcast. Everybody, Happy New Year again. This is Adam Chartoff. And we'll talking to Tony Stella here only on Filmwax Radio. How you doing?
Good. Holding on. I got an early start. I sent my parents up before this morning. They're on their way, and I'm sort of on coffee and deadlines, running low on fumes. But
we didn't have to do it this evening. If you're
no, it's perfect. Perfect. I'm all good. It's all. This is a permanent state. You know, there's no refuge from this. How do you prefer to do this? How do you want to talk about the movies first, or should we just launch into it, or should we use this as a jumping off point? How do you usually like to do it?
For instance, did you see Mother yet? No, because it's not. No. It's going to be a while.
No,
it'll be a while.
You know, here all this stuff comes out so late.
Takes a little while. I know. Yeah. No, big deal. Because you know, it's a rare thing. I posted. I don't ever do this, but because I don't usually pay to like a patron to go to the movies. But yeah. I said, you know, I was in the mood to catch something this weekend. So I sort of posted Mother or It, you know, and a lot of people were pro It. But I ended up actually, a friend of mine came in from Manhattan, and we ended up seeing Mother. So, and I could see why.
Yeah, what do you think?
I liked it. It challenges you because it's not really a typical conventional narrative. It's like a kind of allegorical, you know, type of that's crazy. I think, you know, some of the last scenes are really just outrageous because it's
I'm not sure in the States, did they use the one sheet that was actually painted? Did they use some of the artwork, or was it the kind of Rosemary's Baby head that's on its way, kind of the quote to Rosemary's Baby? It's just her head and then the house small for the posters. Because Mother was one of the rare movies that I was actually, oh, look, they're starting to use artwork again. They're starting to like focus on the hand-drawn stuff. Because over here,
I
think it was a hand-painted poster, at least for the pre, you know, that's what they do. The pre-release is nice, and then the main thing comes in. That's sort of Photoshop.
Yeah, by the time the you know, goes online or on DVD or something, it's like,
that's perfect. My ultimate bane is always like, every time you get asked to do these things and you're like, oh, wow, you get your hopes up, and they're like, it ends up being just a giveaway, you know, something they hand out to the press, and then it just becomes these floating heads photoshopped in at the end, and you're like, why did I even fucking try so hard? It's like, it's something that that's plaguing me, and we're in such a strange annex in time where people crave, there's so much nostalgia for analog and film, and the poster is actually making a resurgence. You know, I'm making a living, but on the other hand, we've never seen worse posters. I mean, this is just from posters that you wouldn't believe, like, you know, and I always rant with James from Wrong Reel about this, because, you know, the companies that actually made their bones on the artists, like Marvel, DC, and some of these people are still alive. Steven Steranko, you know, he would make an awesome Captain America poster. Why? How is such a company like Disney doesn't grasp this, or Star Wars? You know, this is the most awful poster.
I guess they just apply marketing components and they just slap them together. I mean, on a poster, right? To appeal to whoever they feel like they're going to appeal to bring people into.
But you would think they would. You would really think that these people are attuned to that. There's a huge collector's market and these special editions. And, you know, I mean, that's really the niche that you still have. You know, and you know, old men are collecting robots and stuff. You know,
yeah.
The Star Wars posters still have currency because they were painted by artists. You know.
Yeah. Well, let's push forward. Let's try to get this back on track. Get people's priorities in order. You know, like, this is there is a market for it, because there are a lot of people that are really you know, committed to like collecting these types of posters, and, you know, really get. I mean, I just remember my childhood, older cousins, and having, like, I'd go there and they'd have the Midnight Cowboy. Okay, granted, that was not a hand, it wasn't an illustration.
Yeah,
but
beautiful photography, you know, or just like beautiful off screen.
And iconic images, you know, of like Joe Buck walking with his shoulders hunched up and his hands in his pockets, and Ratso Rizzo kind of, you know, shuffling alongside of him. That was like the poster.
And the amazing thing was each country had 2-3 versions. So you don't only have the official one, but you have each. Each Germany used to have the thing where they made one for the countryside and one for the sophisticated taste in the city.
The urban and the provinces. One for the provinces.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. One for the farmers.
What is the art? But they'd be different artists.
Right? Yeah, totally different artists. Yeah. Or sometimes the same, and they just give them different tasks. Like Conan the Barbarian, Renato Cassaro artist, Italian artist that used to work in Germany, and one for the countries, you know, Conan just bristling, just like, more tits, more on both on Arnold and the girl. And then for the country, it was more like a Frank Frazetta, beautiful kind of, you know, more laid back one. But and so this is the first image right before you're allowed to see this. You stand at the VHS and you just dream through those images, through the artwork you relay. This must be amazing. And then when you finally get to see it, you're like, oh my God, this doesn't hold up. The artwork is actually better than.
Did your parents, were they big film watchers? What's your.
Yeah, huge. There. I mean, my father's in theater, my mother's an architect, but she used to always break every time my father made some crazy show, avant-garde piece. She did the programs. It was very much like a circus family. So I used to come home and there was like actors in my room practicing roles. And I was like, I was a little conservative guy. I was actually, I fled to the movies, and my father would always challenge me. And he was always like, what are you watching? I'm like, Rocky. And he's like, you should watch Jodorowsky because you don't know what's real. And, you know, and so we very much have till this day, this relationship where we stay up late nights and watch movies together.
Really? That's nice.
And like the whole history, then I was friends with, in Munich with, a kid from, they ran Unifrance, which was the French distributing company of all the French films in Europe. And so his house was just, I mean, the only thing that was open was like the door frames and the windows. Everything else was VHS. So we used to come home late nights from doing graffiti, and the mother was still up watching films on 2 screens, one in the kitchen, one in the living room. And she put films on our desk and was like, watch this on a school night. And she's like, you haven't seen this. You have to watch the Antoine Doinel series. And like this, it was really cool. So we used to watch like 5-6 films a night. Just,
wow.
That was currency. But I was never a strong reader, but I at one point I made the decision. I was like, I'm just going to watch everything that comes my way. I'm just going to watch it. Drawing into it, obviously, and then through like looking at the stuff, like making my own covers, and then dreaming on the narrative, you know, because you know back then it was so hard to, you had to wait so long for something. There was no sequel guaranteed, or you catch a beginning and then never the end because it was on TV late nights, you know. And then
Where was this in Italy, I suppose?
Italy, Germany, but mostly like we used to move every 2 years because my father would take whatever job in the theater he could take.
Oh,
so
okay.
It was, I never had really had a home, and I really, every time I moved to Italy, I feel really German. Every time I'm in Germany, I feel really Italian or something else, and I actually was most happy in other places, Japan or where I was truly a foreigner and an outsider. I lived in Milano for a long time, but also in Tokyo, and I just moved all over the place.
Tokyo.
Finally, Berlin, because it was just the most affordable, you know.
Great, and I guess it's great because it's not only a, you know, it's also an international, really international city.
Yeah, New York was always a dream, but yeah, that became a little bit.
You're young, man. You're young yet, so there's still time, you know.
Yeah, maybe, but it has to go down again. Somehow, something has to happen. I actually, you know, last time I was there, I came out and asked her a place, and it's this giant Citibank building. I'm like, ties into all the films that we'll be talking about, because this is some weird this nostalgia that you have for a time that maybe you weren't even present for. You know, a lot of people weren't there, but New York had such a radiance out into the world, that 80s, 70s New York, that it fed all our imagination around the globe. And when we come back to it, it's almost you take ownership. And my dad, I remember, he has a super strong accent. And he came to New York, and his English is really bad. And he came to New York, and it was the first place he also said, like, I feel great because nobody speaks English well or something, you know. He was so exhilarated, like he wasn't anymore sticking out.
I see that, like, New York isn't, having grown up in the city, it's not the New York City that I grew up in. And I don't want to be the old, grumpy Gus you should have been here in the, you know, because it's safe and it's cleaner in a lot of ways. And those are good things, but also it's lost a lot of its grit. So when a lot of its authenticism, maybe to some degree. Yeah. You know, so it's a lot of the institutions.
Yeah. Well, the thing that made it unique, because now, you know, you go to Kreuzberg, you go to all these, there's a neighborhood like that everywhere now, Camden and London and stuff, but it used to be only in New York you could find this mix of people, this kind of melting pot and this unique atmosphere. And yeah, it's weird because you don't want to be, first of all, the grumpy guy or the guy that always like nostalgia for crime, which is weird, you know, but something happens when the neighborhood is dangerous. We had it now here in Berlin. In New York, it took 20 years. In Berlin, it took 10 years. And it just went so fast, and it just became unaffordable. The artists got driven out. That made it interesting in the first place. And, you know, where my studio is, it's a bunch of dentists around me, and they keep writing me letters to evict me every day, and because they want to build on top of my studio, which is still in a bomb crater, kind of. And you're allowed to build these things again. So it's hugely valuable, but as long as I don't move out, I don't do anything crazy, they can't really do anything as long as I pay the rent. But... you feel the pressure moving in extremely.
Miss one
quickly.
Month, and you know.
As I say
in New York, referencing your comment about not missing crime, but I always say, you know, I can't find anywhere to get mugged in the city anymore. You know, as hard as I look. You know, like walking, I could have walked home last night, you know, after the movie. I went out with a friend of mine who I saw the movie with Mother with, and he came into Brooklyn. I had already been not that it's that far, but I had already been downtown in Manhattan earlier in the day for something else, and I had just gotten home and I changed, and then he's like, hey, let's go see Mother, and I was like, okay, but do you mind coming to Brooklyn? So he did. We met at this theater, and then afterwards, everything's closed because it's sort of midnight already, and you know, in that area, Brooklyn's very residential, so a lot of stuff is open at midnight normally, but in this particular area. So we ended up getting a couple of beers and then walking to the subway. And, you know, it was like 1:30 in the morning. And I was going to walk home, but I realized I would get home at like, it would take me in like probably close to an hour, maybe 40. And I would be going through some pretty desolate areas. But I wasn't really worried so much about getting mugged or anything. But I just realized, you know, why spend the kind of time it's going to take to get there? And so... Yeah. Okay, well, it's been fun, and we'll pick this up some other time.
Nice!
No. I was kind of curious as to some of your background. I listened to a couple of your appearances on Wrong Reel, of course, and I myself am in an upcoming episode. They were holding on to it until I launched my first Kickstarter.
Oh, cool.
It's going to be momentarily.
Yeah, I'll promote it. Let me know. I mean, I'll see it through Wrong Reel anyhow.
Yeah. But I didn't have a sense of what your way into, first of all, becoming an illustrator, and then also, like, just the obsession with film. I didn't know where that came from.
Yeah, there's an interesting story that links in kind of to TV Party as well. A friend of mine had a, in the 90s, he had a club, cinema club in Munich, Germany, and we had the actual projection screen of Fassbender's Türkendeutsch, which was the Turkish Dagger, which was his cinema. And it got torn down, and we saw the building site, and we kind of gave him a crate of beer, and as they were chucking out the projection, the actual canvas, the, how do you call it, the projection screen.
Yeah, the screen.
And they were stuffing it in a giant container, and we're like, hey, you have some beers, we're taking this. And they're like, yeah, whatever, they didn't care. So my friends had this cinema club in this abandoned building right in the center of Munich, and it became this sort of little cult thing, like this is very much like TV party. At first it was like four or five people, and we used to get dressed up and play like instruments. And I used to, in that abandoned building, then artists started to move in, and I used to advertise for the movies that we would show.
Right.
Just by hand-painted posters. And it just got crazy. And then I remember one screening of Apocalypse Now, and I sort of did the whole scenes as you walk down. It was like storyboards. And I was always the guy drawing. I was always the guy painting, because we're all graffiti writers to start with. That was the connection.
I see. And, okay, right.
And then everybody was musicians, and everybody was doing this. And so it then, as it became time to make some money, I started to already – you know, get sort of editorial jobs for magazines, but it was all boring. It was sort of, you know, like draw a couple having lunch or a parking lot and houses. And then I was like, I want jobs. I want covers. I don't want to tell this narrative story. And the thing that I loved so much with all my friends was discussing movies all night, talking movies. That was our currency. How much did you know? How much could you quote and all this stuff? And this was then, I did this for myself for years, and then my friends, I'm only recently online, I think maybe 3 years. I've never put any of this stuff out. Uh-huh. I got jobs, and they were used here and there, and my friends looking through the archives, and they're like, you're crazy, you're an idiot, why don't you put this stuff out? And I used to scan it again, all the artwork, because it's all analog.
Right.
So I didn't even have files. So first I started photographing it, and then it was really difficult to even find a way to, you know, represent the that you don't lose the texture when you scan it. I didn't even know how to do that.
What size were the posters? What size?
Sorry?
What size were they?
They're all European sheet size, which is a kind of A0. It's a sort of a Europe half sheet of an American size. In Europe after the war, they were all kind of denormed, which was a kind of same thing to fit all the different spaces. And it was all kind of regimented German style after the war to fit in these things. So I was straight away worked in this format. It was a kind of convenient, and you found a lot of paper like that as well.
Oh, already. I see. So are you, they were like displays, cases or
yeah.
Whatever, displays?
Super rough. Yeah, just not even cases. I just used to just plaster them on the wall, staple them. They got ripped down, they got tagged on. And then these were the early days, and actually a lot of them are lost. And they were never meant to be to last. And then sort of as Criterion Collection came up and sort of the rare collector's items started to come up again, and people didn't want to license the original artwork because it's often mired in rights and stuff. So they commissioned a lot of young artists to do their covers, which was in a way where everything's online now. People actually, why should I buy this DVD collection? Because there's extra interviews, but it also has a reinterpretation of the cover art. And so now Arrow Films and Shout Factory and Criterion, a lot of little labels or even Zeitgeist Films who distributed Downtown 81, they're asking artists to do posters again. And there's been a little mini renaissance in attention through actually online. And ever since I went online, it kind of doubled and exploded, and I get jobs all the time. I'm constantly working now.
Oh, my
and,
God. So it started.
I just started my Instagram. You know, I set my Instagram for 3 days because people always demand more and more. And I was so happy just with Tumblr. And then everybody said, "Why are you just on Tumblr? You need Twitter." And I mean, I never had Facebook till 3 years
ago.
It's
too much.
I just kept that totally at bay.
So it started because the explosion started because a lot of these distributors of these reissues didn't want to pay for original artwork.
Yeah, a lot of the for example, I obviously prefer, the most beautiful thing is that you have the original artwork, and what Shout Factory, for example, does, if they can, they have the original cover on one side, and you can flip it, and you get a new interpretation of the work, which often gives new energy and attention to
right.
something. And But often it is, I know from experience, the beautiful Bob Peak originals are just mired in rights and sort of, you know, hard to track down who actually owns the rights of the work, or some are in such bad conditions that were never in digital copy, so to scan the poster, it becomes difficult. And I think Criterion was the most clever because they have the most radical artists. I mean, you see a lot of the other works are using the kind of sterile Photoshop images, but Criterion has good taste, and so what they do, they really take care in selecting their people and commissioning, and you know, their quality differences here and there, but in general I think it's due to them that or for example Rialto Films in New York, you know, Film Forum, they commission posters again for their re-releases, and you sort of see in Film Forum you always have like, oh wow, this is actually a new poster for, you know, until...
Okay, so how many posters have you designed for Criterion, say?
Well, for Criterion, I have almost none. I mean, I propose a lot, but it's hard to get through.
I'm sure.
More
right.
for Shout Factory, much more for littler, smaller labels. And I love them. I definitely respect them, but there is definitely also a kind of, I don't want to say snobism to it, but I totally get
I
where they're coming
that.
From. I mean, it's just a highly selective
yeah,
crowd
no, I get it.
That they're catering to.
No, I get it. Of course it is, and that makes sense. I mean, it's a lot of pedigree, and they know it. So do you, like, draw – are some of the illustrations that you do then, are they kind of on spec, or do you, you know, love – like when you do a film poster for something that already has a cover, has a poster rather, but you still want to make – obviously, it increases your chance of being discovered.
Yeah, and the great thing, I think, for me was always that the intention of the work is always just paying homage to the film. I that's why I call myself an illustrator. That's why I really don't show the less of my personalities out there, the better. And I really work because I love the films foremost. And then I make them just for myself. It became this crazy manic passion project. I have over 400 original posters that I made. And sort of some people license them because they like something already. But other times it's just for me. I made 3 versions of Throne of Blood because I didn't like the first one anymore. Something I noticed a different aspect. And I think it comes from me. I'm always shocked when the designers haven't seen the film. There are a lot of people who admit they're like, oh, you know, I'm not into film. Yeah. This,
what?
It's shocking in interviews what you hear, and I'm always there raging, you know, in my little studio. I'm like,
of course.
For me, first of all,
can you
it's
imagine?
The movie.
Why wouldn't you give? Okay, I mean, if I was going to commission an illustrator to do a poster of my film, and there was one guy who was talented but didn't have any interest in the film, and then there was this other guy who was like kind of nuts about film in general and very, you know, happy to watch the film, and then, you know, it's pretty clear where I'd go, you know.
Yeah, but it's sort of like the art world on a less high level because it's not that much money involved. But the same thing happens very much. It's very cliquey, and it's very you have to be in the right crowd. You have
right.
to not, you know, you have to act in certain ways or like you said before, the cachet that's online. They, after a while, you start to build a narrative. For me, for example, I think people are always shocked that there's so much. And then they get turned off because they think, oh, it can't be good because, you know, he's just doing all – it must be quick or he must be working so much. But actually, I've been doing them since the early 90s, so mid-90s. So I have this huge archive, and I try to post on my Tumblr every day a poster.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I repost them, but usually it's something that – I find or I rework, or it's just something new that, you know, I work with a guy from LA who's amazing, my favorite designer working today, the Midnight Marauder.
Mm-hmm.
He has beautiful posters, and we often do collaborations just quickly. We rewrite each other, and we're like, oh, this is a movie we both didn't get, but we have great stuff for it, so we combine it. Or he did this amazing run on Robert Altman just because he wanted to do all the Altman homages, and so he built a website for all the posters, and they just live on that website. And then people, obviously, the beautiful thing is then people, if they discover through that passion that they discover the work, and they actually use it, because most of it goes unused. I mean, racks of just work here that is just I haven't seen in years because they're so far down.
Is it right over
there? And I'm scanning them.
It's right over there?
Yeah,
you're
it's in
over.
The other room. And,
oh.
And I also have a studio, so I'm at home right now, but the studio is just packed to the gills.
I can imagine.
I don't even know.
So on a typical week, are you doing like one or two?
Yeah, at least I try to do 2 or 3 or 4. And sometimes I'm on this run where it comes easy, and sometimes, you know, life just comes in between, and you got to do, you got to take some jobs, some other jobs that are less editorial there. I try to keep it film-based, but usually it's something that, you know, I did this brochure for an airport, which is a horrific work, but it pays the bills. But then, you know, I try to, what's really great is that this instant feedback of Twitter or Tumblr, that you get so much love for them, that this really is something I never had. They were sort of, you know, produced for this void. I saw the film and people that maybe caught it in our theater saw it, or they came to the studio saw it, but it was not something. Now I get so much because this community of film lovers online, there is a really great camaraderie, even on Wrong Reel with James. They're so generous, actually, because we all share the love for the film. So there's a great communication through the art, through back through the movies, and then through conversations. And I find it incredibly positive. And I was sort of an old curmudgeon already. I kind of said everything online is wrong because it takes away the unique image and, you know, sort of, yeah, as we talked about before, the decay of these special cultures. But as it actually turns out, there are these great pockets of actually great positive energies.
Right. And I
didn't discover your show until recently, but when you reached out and I looked at the archive, I was mind blown that this exists. I was like, this is incredible. You know, Charles Burnett, John Borman, it's just all, you can go through this archive and it's just incredible to get all these intimate conversations and questions that you wanted to ask, you know, but you never got a chance to. I mean, who would dream to interact with them? You know, this is fantastic. And that sort of, I use them while I work and I listen to the podcast. And this is something that would have never been possible even in the 90s, where you stood in front of a VHS rack and wondering what to rent, you know, that night.
Yeah, it's all through the, I mean, if you look at the way the original idea behind the way the internet was even pitched, in the sense that they're going to say, this is going to make this, you know, people that have specific, I mean, this is kind of what it was originally fashioned for. It exploded into a delivery system for advertising, of course, and a way of getting people's personal information. But if you get out of the more cynical, you know, part of it, and you can, as you say, get back to the original advantage of the internet, which was to be able to connect and to with people, particular people, and find people with similar passions or interests or what have you. So it is true. It's great in that regard, you know.
Yeah, I find it, and even like, I'm sure what happened to you is the same thing, that once you start to go and you have that 10-12 episodes, and you start to get proud of your archive because you really go, oh, I must do the next one. It's sort of, and when you're done, you're like, oh, God, this was exhausting. I don't know if I can do it again. But it becomes so exhilarating. It's like climbing the mountain again. In the morning, you look out the window, maybe I should go out again, you know, because it was, you know, it's a rush to see that there's actually, you're building something again. And you're not waiting for, you know, other people to decide for you, oh, we like this, and then it gets mired in this process. By the time you're done, there's almost nothing left of the spark that you had started with. But you kind of, you know, this Crispin Glover interview, for example, the recent show you did, it's you capture these people at this moment in time, and then it goes around the world. I hear it in Berlin at night working on a poster, and it links something else. It's really unique and positive, and I can't, like, overstate how much this advice of my friend has just to scan them and put them online like help me also not get bitter about everything. You know, I was very bitter already seeing new movies and loving these old films and just seeing a regression over and over, and everybody, did you see Takeshi Miike's Harakiri? And I was like, no, this is not the right thing, you know, I mean, this is my Kobayashi's film, why you don't know anything? And I became sort of very, very grumpy. And then you go online and you see a lot of people know what you know, and they're equally passionate, and it just becomes this a really, really, really cool exchange.
Right, or you know far more than, because of your level of passion and OCD or you know, autism, I don't know, but you become you realize how much more you know, and then you go online, you find people that all of a sudden dwarf what you thought, all of a sudden you're feeling inadequate. You know, I mean, I feel like it's very, very contextual whether or not I'm obviously a film fanatic, but I'm not. I there's a lot of gaps, you know, still. So I just work. It's a work in progress, because for me, there's the breadth. I kind of work in the breadth of things, and sometimes the height is over here, and the width is over here. I kind of have a desire to know a fair amount about a lot.
Yeah. And the great thing is you rediscover a lot. Films you've seen, you give another chance. Other things, you know, you have these entire gaps to fill. And it's almost like with collecting music. I used to collect LPs basically from 1972 to 1978, very specific. And for over 20 years, used to DJ. I know a lot about funk and soul and jazz in that era. Mm-hmm. But I still am mesmerized. I still find new things. And you're like, how much deeper is this well? You know,
yeah. It's exactly right. I experience that all the time with film. That it's going to be like that with, of course, podcasts and anything else. It's interesting. You mentioned also just a minute ago about, you know, like the Crispin Glover and how in the moment it is. And it's true. You know, every time I have on somebody, like I just did one with a filmmaker he's an older guy and he has like 20 some films he's made because he's been on once before. And we just talked about his latest work. And I thought it would be great to bring him back on and do a career look, you know, or career review. And, you know, and we did do that, but, you know, it's something about it is a little bit smarmy or I'm cheating or something. Like, I feel like I am more interested in where that guy is now in his 80s. So it's interesting. I don't think that's crystallized in my head until just now. Even if somebody has a career of 20 films, yes, we're going to touch on it, but I want to really know where he's at now and his reflection back. Yes, because that's part of it. Like, when you were making this, tell me some anecdotes about with Orson Welles, you know, when you met Orson Welles. I want, you know, of course we want to hear that, but I'm kind of interested to know, like, what he feels about people now and where film's at now. It's like, and then, you know, that's, to me, maybe more about what the show is about, that it feels very much in the moment. You know, because I think a lot of these guys do with the career discussions, you know? So if I get somebody I can get somebody on for an hour, somebody's, you know, who's really been around forever, and I still feel like, let's try to be as much in the moment as possible. I think that's maybe what I can do.
I think so. I mean, you certainly did on the Dick Cavett one. That was brilliant. And I think my favorite documentaries on art is never when they interpret the work and they go in back into the work. But I want to see him make a cup of coffee. What is his ritual right now? You know, those are the really valuable things. Like, how does he enter the studio? How does he, this is his seat. Does he read over there? And if you manage to tap that, obviously, you must have this, like, in the back of your mind, you're talking to Dick Cavett, all these great shows, and we want to geek out about which guests. But it never got there. It's just so great. It always was like, remember that? And then he's like, you guys were really fast at a level that was really intimate. And it was not, you know, the let's go over things, because we all love that time. Right. But it was almost like in two sentences that was done. It was really great that you can connect on that level so quickly. Because oftentimes, you know, I feel the same. I feel this burden when I talk about Kobayashi, who I love, on Wrong Reel. You know, I go, oh my God, I must pay homage to all this stuff. And you get bogged down in his school days, you know. But it's actually just talk about what you love about it, you know.
Very much. But still, the John Borman was it was a lot of fun. And we did talk about his career, too. But you had to, there was... When you have somebody who's made so many different kind of crazy films like he has. Speaking of which, I'm Harry Dean Stanton, of course, just died. You've already made several beautiful homage posters for that, for him and in his memory. Just coincidentally, he has a new film coming out in a couple of weeks. I think he has one more movie that he made that's still probably in post-production or whatever. I don't know if he's a lead in this next one or if he's, you know, whatever, but I know that in this current one that's about to come out, Lucky, Harry Dean Stanton is the lead in it, and he's almost in almost every scene. So he had to be like pushing 90 when he made the film. And the filmmaker is also an actor, John Carroll Lynch. He does a lot of TV, but he was in Fargo. He played in the original Coen Brothers movie. He played Marge's husband.
Yeah.
I remember that actor.
Yeah.
So he's coming on, so I'm looking forward to next week meeting with that guy because I met him once before at a party and chatted with him. I was like really geeked to meet the guy who was in Fargo, you know, opposite Frances McDormand. You know, I just thought he was so funny making her breakfast because she was pregnant, you know. And he was an illustrator too, wasn't he? Didn't he like draw ducks or something or mallards?
Yeah,
or, do you remember that?
No, I can't remember. But with Harry Dean Stanton, obviously it was – We're all waiting for this to happen. And in Europe, he was kind of, because through Wim Wenders, obviously, he was a real star, whereas in America, he was still waiting. He was kind of, you know, Ride the Whirlwind. Yeah. He was Straight Time. But in Germany, if you look on the posters, it's Harry Dean Stanton is often mentioned above titles of other actors, where on the American posters, you look, it's Jack Nicholson, and down at the bottom, only in the really small print is Harry Dean Stanton. A lot of the German posters have him high on top of the list because, actually selling it through Wenders and this actor was really mythical over here.
Wow. Yeah. He's a guy who really may be one of the only people out there that bridged the old Hollywood with like the art film. Like, you know, like he did it all. You know, when people say that actor did it all, they aren't actually accurate because they did a lot, but not at all. Whereas Harry Dean Stanton, he's really, really done it all. You know, he went from the Hollywood studio era to making a lot of offbeat films, and he was part of the new wave. You know, he obviously worked with all the great young Turks.
Popping up in Alien and all these things.
Any
genre, and you would. It feels so generous when you look at that from the outside, because this is something I value a lot, is that there is no... It's the anti-snob, right? You're in an action film, then you're in an art film, then you're in a TV show. There's no hierarchy. It's so beautiful when somebody manages to stay true to himself and authentic.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be precious with your projects. And I feel this is something so today our generation is suffering a lot, that you know, you manage your career so carefully, you become in these boxes. And then it's something that I value greatly is somebody who manages to go through there and stay true to himself, and whatever project it is, you still have the core there. You never felt he sold out. This is not somebody who sold out, no matter how big he is or no matter how small the thing is. You don't go, oh, there goes his career, you know, now he's doing this.
Nobody's going to ever blame a failure on Harry Dean Stanton, his performance. If a film flops, it's not because Harry Dean Stanton was in it. That was like, you know, probably one of the hopeful components of your film. You know, if you still manage to blow it, it's on you. It's not on him.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why you would rent it. You're like, how bad could this be? He's in it for 2 minutes, you know?
Exactly. But for a lot of us, of course, Paris, Texas was our introduction, if not Alien, between the two films. You know, but because Paris, Texas, he really carried the film, whereas in Alien, it was a real ensemble film. And as a young guy, because I remember I didn't quite sneak into Alien, but I was definitely underage, and I went in with a girl from junior high school.
Nice.
I remember her, Alice, and we went into Manhattan. I don't know what we were thinking, because it was like terrifying film, of course. You know, for how old were we? Like 13? I mean, what year did that come out? 79?
Yeah, 79.
Was it 79? Alien? The first Alien?
I think, yeah.
So maybe maybe it was high school then. Let me think. Yeah, it must have been high school. So anyway, but the point is, I was definitely under 17. I was definitely under 17, and they just sort of let us in. Back then, I guess they were just a little less rigid about it. They kind of, I remember looking askance and not believing that we were older than 17.
But yeah, that was terrifying. I caught it on TV and I wouldn't sleep after that. But I kind of imagine taking a girl into that.
Anyway, yeah, that's a huge loss. I mean, yeah, like you say, though, 91 years old, pretty good run. Pretty good run for Harry Dean Stanton. He worked right up to the last minute, it appears.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in Lucky, I only saw the poster. I actually didn't see much of the footage, but I think that's him on the poster right from the back, those skinny legs, and he's stanked out over with the cowboy hat on there.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's like, yeah, I mean, it's like a skeleton.
Well,
now,
wisely, they wrote
there.
A part that was like custom built for him. I mean, I'm sure he took it because it was just the kind of role that's going to be perfect for Harry Dean. I'm sure it's an archetypal type of character. And speaking of Alien, there is a reunion in there between him and Tom Skerritt.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, nice. He's awesome.
They have a scene together, so it's pretty awesome.
Cool.
So that's one of the next people I'm interviewing is the director of that film, Lucky.
That's so great that you can grab these people. How do you usually because everybody obviously comes through New York at one point at a
right.
time. But is it connected to some kind of are you connected to some kind of cinema where you actually get? I saw some pictures of you like talking on screenings actually or something. How do you actually encounter?
Well, those are two different things. In terms of booking people, there's two different ways. One is I have a relationship with most of the publicists, so I get press releases about films as they come out, and they tell you, besides what the movie's about, they tell you all the people involved, who's available for maybe press. Like if I get the press release for Lucky, they'll say something like John Carroll Lynch is doing select interviews or whatever. And yeah, they normally come into New York, so...
Yeah, I love when I'm not, for me, of course, as a kind of graffiti kid, I was blown away. You had Charlie Ahern and these reoccurring guests, like friends of yours,
yeah.
I guess now.
Oh no,
like that's for me. Oh my god, that like the Deadly Art of Survival. That was our movie, and all of a sudden, nobody talks about this. No one talks about this. And to go down your list first, I'm scrolling down. I'm like, oh, I'm marking this one. Ooh, I'm marking this one. And then Charlie Ahern. I'm like, oh wow, Wild Style, and
I know.
Like, and you guys going through his 8mm work and just his Times Square film. And it's just that was incredible. So I love these that it's not only kind of the big movies that are coming out, but you get these reoccurring people that you talk to that you
yeah.
feel like, oh, it's from the neighborhood or you guys.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, that's one thing I love as a sort of an effect of the show or a result of the show. I love creating a community of people that I can and hopefully you'll be in there, Tony. You know, I love the idea of having a bunch of people that I can keep inviting back on. And, you know, it's not because, yeah, if a small number of people or a large number of people know who they are, great. But it's to me, it's because they're supportive. They're fun to talk to. They enjoy doing it. They're supportive. You know, it's like a number of different things.
And there's still an enthusiasm. I think this is so cool. When you hear it, it's not... It's so alive that they become so mythical for us or my generations, like somebody, and he's still out, he's still looking at young people, he's still, that is so encouraging, you know. He's
yeah,
not,
especially
they still know what's going on way more than I know what's going on.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah, no, he is so, you know, wired into what's going on, and Ahern is a really great example, and he also helps to bring us to the thrust of our episode, of course,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
I think I kind of co-hosted a screening, very vaguely, though. It was like at the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival, and I was supposed to be a co-host or presenter of a Wild Style anniversary screening. It goes back so far now, it's hard to remember. You know, people want to constantly screen that film, Wild Style. So everybody wants to do an anniversary screening. Yeah, I'm going to do the 27th anniversary screening of, you know, Wild Style.
Every year.
The big 27, the big 27, you know. But it was fun. And, you know, he's happy to talk about Wild Style and the Deadly Art, but he is so of his own, he's still so relevant and interested in what's going on today, because you know the things that he was there, he kind of helped build the hip-hop scene as far as the general public, the way they see hip-hop. He was there at the start, and he helped fashion that, you know. And if you look at Wild Style, what I love so much about it is it just captures that early hip-hop era, which was still so positive and so grassroots, you know? And
yeah, and no boundaries as well. It was new wave, punk, heavy metal, funk, before the records actually came out.
Yeah.
I mean, that
right,
was
people
great.
Get bootlegs.
And Star Wars, same year, 1983, it was the Tony Silva film, the documentary where you see Scene and Is the Wiz and all these guys. And then actually the Subway Art came out, the book by Martha Cooper and Henry Chalfant. And it was just 2-3 years. And we still live with that legacy. It's so incredible that it bled over through Europe. And we knew friends from Munich who were in New York 1982 painting trains and bringing things back to us. And
yeah.
These became these sort of totems and relics because you couldn't screen. I mean, there was not even a VHS of it, you know. And so you would have through drawings. And it's incredible to imagine that now, that something like a drawing could, over in Europe, reunite this whole style of painting and drawing letters. And there was no way to communicate in any other way. It's archaic, really.
Speaking of which, after Wild Style, much more recently, of course, he did a documentary about a street photographer.
Jamal, sure.
Jamal Shabazz.
Jamal Shabazz,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually how I first really came into contact with him because I was already doing the film stuff. I don't remember how I met him originally anymore. I don't remember the circumstances. I just can't remember. I have to put some thought into it. But he was instrumental in my going back to, you know, because this was happening in my childhood, you know. In my teenage years, more accurately, late teenager years, going into high school, going to college is when all this was happening. So, you know, I was just living it in the neighborhood in Queens that I grew up in, not realizing there was this whole incredible movement going on. And we talked about in high school, it was like the conversation was rock versus disco.
Yeah.
But really what was going on was...
Even though it's arguably some of the best MCs of all time came out of Queens, you know?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Certainly LL and so many others.
And Nas, yeah.
Yeah, right, Nas. And then years later, I would be working at Sony Music. Of course, by then, hip-hop is a corporate entity, and it's been bought and sold to a great extent, but...
Who would have thought that this is the... besides comic books and jazz, the original American art form that kids, the first subculture that truly the kids made up out of exactly then what we're talking about, the internet, the way it was intended and now perverting it. Now you're taking channels and you're opening it up again. I mean, the turntable, making music because you couldn't afford instruments, plugging into the streetlights, dancing because, you know, the Cubs wouldn't let you in because you had sneakers on. And all this actually... The people that founded it didn't get the big payoff, right? It was the fifth, sixth, eighth generation. And that's why these movies out of New York, they radiate till this day this energy. And the downtown scene, like you see, each borough had its own unique identity for us. Of course, it was the South Bronx was there.
Yeah, it's funny because I started this podcast on this company called as an internet radio show called with this company called Bebox, which is brand new, and I was like one of the first people doing a show on there, which then morphed into the podcast I'm doing now. But it was started on the Bebox. They had like this storage retrofitted storage container that was like a recording studio or a radio station. And they would have like hip hop artists. This again is only a few years ago, 5-6 years ago, but they were on the grounds of I think it was called the Albee Street Mall, I think that's what it's called. And it was like this, where there was this mall there before, and they tore it down years ago. But it was a place where all these, it was a very African-American neighborhood, and there were a lot of hip-hop artists used to hang out, apparently, at that space. So it's like kind of considered sacred ground. Now there's another mall there, but it's called City Point, and it's huge, and there's a Target and, you know, everything else. And on the top three floors is an Alamo Draft House. So.
I think, in a lot of ways, that New York culture, that melting pot in talking about, you know, Glenn O'Brien TV party and the way that grew out of New York getting, you know, actually allowing people to have their own public access TV station, actually to be broadcast into the city. That was such an important thing, almost like the internet now, that people actually from the neighborhood could communicate to the neighborhood. And it was supposed to be...
Ahern was one of the earliest filmmakers from that era, the downtown... No Wave scene, which definitely made me nostalgic for that time when my youth. And I think that's right through this period where as a young man, and I was then living in Brooklyn, and because I grew up in Queens, but I moved to Brooklyn, my first apartment, and after school. And, you know, I started discovering it was like in the late 80s, but it was right around the time where Spike and Jarmusch and a bunch of other filmmakers were coming out of the city. And it was that period of time which I started feeling very nostalgic. So talking to Ahern started getting me motivated to try to find some of these other folks, some of these other filmmakers that came out of that time. And it's been hard. So many of them are not so easy. They don't always want to do some press. But you know, I have at the New York Film Festival coming up, Sarah Driver has a new documentary about Basquiat.
Yeah.
Speaking of the main film we wanted to touch on is Downtown 81, which... is Basquiat playing sort of a quasi-fictional account of a day in his life where he's getting evicted because he can't make his rent, and so he has to try to figure out how he's going to make his rent in the course of the day, and we just follow along with him as he's going from one misadventure to another, then he hits the clubs, and we get some of the most amazing live acts out of the day.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, glorious, yeah. I think it came out of TV Party. They were on for 4 years, and they finally got money. Somebody gave them an obscene amount of money from back then, and they were like lured away from TV Party to actually make a film.
Right.
I think, yeah, it was screenplay by Glenn O'Brien, and Murray Paul produced it, and Ed Battaglio, who was also part of the kind of TV Party photographer, he shot a lot of the camera on TV Party, he was the director, and they kind of, this film became so mythical because it was shot in 1980-81 from December to 6 weeks till January, and then it never came out, so you saw stills. In each art catalog, I would eat those up. It's Basquiat playing the tennis sax in front of the Empire State Building or the Guggenheim, and you're like, well, where is this from? And it's this movie called New York Beat. And I'm like, well, New York Beat, and it's, wow, it's Glenn O'Brien, and you're slowly piecing it together. You saw same old on TV Party snippets, and then around the 2000s it came out, maybe 1999, it came out through Zeitgeist Films. They reintroduced it, and I think it was screened at Cannes. And it hit you like, oh my God, this movie really had such an impact on all of us, because not only did it connect us to all these figures that we love from that time, but who we also mimicked in Europe, you know, growing up in the mid-90s even, was linking some of that scene and that art. It was still so palpable and present.
Mm-hmm.
And when you finally get to see it, I mean, I saw this movie so many times. Like, we used to do screenings of it in our little cinema. And seeing Basquiat before fame hit him. And, and the movie has his first canvases. He never painted a canvas before because they sort of got art materials for him.
For people listening who may not know, you mentioned Samo. Before Basquiat was known, he was sort of this underground figure that people knew, like a number of other people, through their tags. He was a graffiti artist or a street artist, whatever, known as Samo.
Yeah, and he was, what was so special about his graffiti as compared to everybody else's tags, everybody sort of had their name.
Right.
And, you know, they would stylize their name. That's the conventional, almost very conventional graffiti. But he used to do these multiple choice questions or just write these beautiful poetic sentences all around the village, like the origins of cotton or, all these very Dada surrealist quotations. And he was so sophisticated because at the time he was sort of homeless, but he was 18, 19 years old. This is incredible that you would be this fine-tuned.
Yeah.
And you see it in the film. I mean, I saw Schnabel's film first with Jeffrey Wright.
Right. Jeffrey Wright played Basquiat. It was a sort of star-studded indie film, but it was a beautiful film, though.
I love it.
Dennis Hopper's in it.
And Schnabel actually painted all the Basquiat paintings in the movie himself because they wouldn't get the rights from the estate.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's
and
amazing.
They're really beautiful. And I have a lot of admiration for that performance in that film. And, you know, amazing David Bowie as Warhol
what are you doing?
Fantastic. And
Dennis Hopper.
And that movie sort of, I saw that first and Jeffrey Wright is doing a great job, but when you see Basquiat, how beautiful he actually was, the actual young Basquiat in there, you like, when you see him move around the street, it's magnetic. When you see Downtown 81, he just has such a pull.
It's like found footage. It was like, wow, there's not only just footage of Basquiat, but he's actually in a movie. 80 some minutes, and he's like in every moment practically of the film, right? Isn't he?
Except for
some of the concert footage, but it's an amazing film. And I think if with a little work he could have been as good as Jeffrey Wright, but we still have to give him his credit for trying to play himself.
He gets the speech and the rhythm really, really well done, but when you see the original, obviously. But what's so fascinating is that's his first time on camera, or maybe TV Party. He used to, you know,
once in a while he used to be on there. Samo,
with the kind of mohawk.
Right. That's right. I forgot. TV Party was So it was like what they call free speech channel.
Public access,
and so this guy Glenn O'Brien. What was he doing before? Was he just a musician himself?
He was writing. He was a journalist. He was a writer actually for Wall, for Interview Magazine. And he had his own column called Glenn O'Brien's Beat.
Mm-hmm.
And Warhol sort of picked him up because he wanted young people around him all the time. And so Walt Disney and all these people that actually came out of the factory. And TV Party is the product of his sort of mind, but also of the kind of idea of the factory people would hang around, creative people, and sort of make movies. And this whole aesthetic of low-grade, amateurish camera is very much from Warhol.
Well, he was able to wrangle two key figures to work with him on the show. One was Amos Poe behind the camera, who's been on this show too. Have you heard that conversation? Did you hear that episode?
Yeah, yeah.
Amos Poe. I've been trying to get him back on because he's got such great stories. I got to get Amos Poe back on the podcast. But Amos Poe is in some circles, he's given the credit as really kind of discovering or founding this experimental underground New York film scene from that period. Like, he was there at the very beginning. Nobody else was going with no money making these films with no real experience or money. And just, I think Jarmusch tells the story in Blank City that, you know, I don't know if you've seen the documentary Blank City, but have you not seen that?
No, I'm
sorry. Oh, you got to see that.
I've
I got to hook
that,
you up
yeah.
with that. Yeah, that's everybody's in that film as well. And Jarmusch really gives Poe the credit for kind of discovering, you know, turning every, like, this whole group of artists and musicians, because they were all dabbling in all the different disciplines anyway. So
that was beautiful, yeah.
You know,
there was no hierarchies in that. So, everybody was playing.
Glenn O'Brien went to the exact right guy who's up for the job. And then for, like, orchestra leader, his Doc Severinsen or Paul Schaefer, he goes to Chris Stein, of course, who was, you know, the main musical force behind Blondie. And was once, I guess, romantically involved with Blondie or Debbie Harry. But anyway, so it's fantastic. I love it that, you know, so TV Party is like lo-fi as you get, but it is so entertaining.
Yeah, and on the other hand, it was always Glenn O'Brien. I think he was a bit of a Fab Five Freddy called mm-hmm. it Downtown Hipster College. And I thought that was really good because the downtown, it was such a small group of creative people that always called different names, but Downtown 200 maybe best describes it. And people go in and out and they come in, like you said, they're artists, they're filmmakers, they're writers, they're poets, everybody, the hierarchy of that, that's what's so magnetizing about that time, that it wasn't about making it or money. People wanted to be famous, but not for all, at all costs. And it became this kind of TV Party became this extended living room where you could see this cast of characters come in and out. And like you said, you had George Clinton come in, or Blondie, or you had Deborah Harry, or John Lurie playing the saxophone in the bag,
right.
David Byrne. And it was really what Glenn O'Brien wanted to fashion, I think, was very much Playboy After Dark. Kind of the Hugh Hefner
show. Right. He talks about that. Have you seen that documentary about TV Party?
Yeah, it's on my DVD on the back. I have the whole box set. I think 2005 something, a whole box set came out with all the episodes.
Oh, that's probably...
maybe the best 50 or something crazy. You know, it's like six DVDs.
I got to get that.
Yeah, it's really fun. You just have it running in the background, you draw to it, and it feels like it's really on TV again.
So Glenn O'Brien did that show for like at least 4 years, and it was just like a drug-fueled...
78 to 82,
okay. Like... Well, yeah, my high school years. Anyway, and then, they got some money in to make Downtown 81, this film, which was kind of like in the tradition, like, you know, just the structure of the film. It was very much like a Wizard of Oz, typical kind of story about that classic, you know, need for him to, you know, get his goal so he could go back home and pay his rent and get back into his apartment, you know, and... Everybody is in that movie. Certainly anybody that had been involved in TV Party ended up on. And there's lots of, almost everybody we've mentioned has, if they're not in the movie in a substantial role, they have a cameo or an uncredited walk-on.
Yeah.
Like Fab.
I mean, from the guy in the corner, the grocer, is somebody that, you know, it's even beyond people that I know. But it's, I think they only cast one person, which was the old lady. And Glenn O'Brien said, like, we didn't know any old ladies. That was the only person they had to cast.
Oh, I see. Yeah, Maripol, though, she's Maripol. And, I mean, everybody that was ever in any of these films that were being made in those days. And John Lurie had a little, like, if you blink, though, you would...
I think John Lurie is actually not in the film. I think there's one scene where people think it's John Lurie, but it's somebody else.
Oh.
I think it's, but he's in TV Party certainly. He's always popping up, and he was very. There's also his music is on there.
He's given an uncredited line in there. Oh, yeah. Where I thought it was the guy.
I think there was somebody really big that people thought was in, but Gallo was in it. Vincent Gallo, and people think he was in it because he was in the group with Basquiat, Michael Holman, Gray.
Right.
And they contributed a lot of the soundtrack. Actually, their equipment gets stolen,
right.
Which is part of the... It's beautiful because it's almost like the Divine Comedy. We see Basquiat traveling through. He's sort of an undisclosed ailment that comes from his own childhood where his spleen was removed. So he has the same scar as Warhol. There's this sort of really beautiful picture of the both of them.
Really?
With their shirts open. They're both wounded because, you know, Warhol, after the gunshot wounds, had this crazy scar going down in the middle of his spine. And there's this amazing, beautiful photo of them. And so Basquiat sort of comes out of hospital and starts out in the clouds. The camera zooms down. And we already know New York is a mythical place. They're setting it up. This is kind of among the gods. And the gods are not anymore... you know, the high society. It's not anymore the people with the power on TV. It's actually the kids. The kids are giving the reins of this beautiful city, and that's what made New York so magical, at least downtown Alphabet City.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Downtown.
It was the kids running the city.
Yeah, well, downtown was, because, no, I mean, the powers that be gave up on the downtown New York. It's like they just gave up on it. So it really was anything goes. This is our country, you know? And... yeah, I remember this. The person who I thought was John Lurie, but it could easily maybe not have been him too, because it's just he was like walking by Basquiat early on, and he just sort of says, "You know, we're going to be at the Mud Club tonight," you know, and kind of just sort of keeps walking. I thought that was John Lurie, but maybe you're right. Maybe it was somebody else.
I thought there was something I recalled that
Dan
O'Brien said it looks much like him, but it's actually this other guy that I don't know about. He also ran a band, who also had something. He has a slick back hair, very much looks like him. But you might be right. I don't know. This, like we said, there's so many. Everybody is somebody in this. It's because and the owner of the Mud Club is actually the guy who's in the strip club who gets his water spilled on him.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these mythical figures come in and out, and you really feel this was by the community, for the community,
right.
And even scenes much later on have been dubbed. It's not always Basquiat's voice. But what's so intensely fascinating to me is it has amazingly high production value, obviously, because you can never get those sets again. You know, you walk through this urban Vietnam, downtown Alphabet City, burned up buildings, and Basquiat's there alone with his canvas. You know, it's so incredible.
It's
has such power, those.
No, it is true. And you can see it a little bit in like early Jarmusch, like Permanent Vacation.
Yeah.
You see it again. They shot probably in this. Supposedly, Jarmusch says that Basquiat was asleep on the floor while they were shooting Permanent Vacation. Like he was in a sleeping bag asleep on the floor, and they would have to, every time they moved the camera, they'd have to pull the sleeping bag along the floor out of the range of the camera. That's supposedly what was going on. I think some of these guys, they look back and they've kind of reinvented some of their anecdotes a little bit, you know, to fit the...
Yeah, that's all part of it. This, I'm sure we did as well for them.
But my favorite parts of Downtown 81 are probably those musical performances. First of all, even though I knew Kid Creole and the Coconuts...
Oh, yeah.
That is like the highlight. That performance at the Peppermint... I think it was at the Peppermint Lounge?
Yeah,
might have been Mud Club. I can't remember. Because there were some great bands.
Mud Club? No, it's not the Mud Club. That was, they did, Mud Club was Walter Standing and
right.
The Dragon.
Right. But, like, also, I just want to mention before I forget, Ardo Lindsay and DNA were in this movie. And who else? There was a...
And what was cool for us, of course, Fat Five Freddy, and you have this cool scene with Lee spray
Lee
painting
Quinones.
Outside, and Basquiat
right.
goes in, and it's actually cool Kyle rapping, but what was so cool, they're rapping to Rapture, the instrumental, but
yes.
he's actually dubbing it as Melly Mel, because Melly Mel redubbed Cool Kyle. So the boundaries are so, it's really great because the boundaries are not set yet. You know, you have punk rock, new wave, hip hop, and these people are not, you know, staking off territory that we have now. Everybody's getting along, you see, they're all shaking hands, and it's just about if you're cool. It's not about what you do so much. It's like, are you cool? Do you fit?
Are you making art? Are you making art? Are you
exactly.
contributing to the cause? And but I think I give Kid Creole, because he would put on the equivalent to like a big band performance. He had on a horn section, he had on the typical, you know, rock band musicians. He had on the girl singers. He had on, I mean, performance in that is like astoundingly good in that. And I could see his, maybe he even influenced David Byrne into expanding his band, and which eventually became Stop Making Sense. or during, you know, that concert tour where he expanded with the brass section, and which then, you know, was caught on by Jonathan Demme. Because I think what Kid Creole was doing there, he had to have invented that.
For sure. I mean, all the exuberance of this lo-fi against this amazing high production, because the musicians were so tight. It was such a good performance. But those suits and those costumes, and I think Mari Paul made some of the costumes. But it was all fused. It was all, I think the lady who made Liquid Sky, she was part of the models in that scene. And it's just, it's so intense because we're presented with this condensed world that has been living that authentically for so long, and all of a sudden somebody actually shoots this and it becomes this amazing document that hasn't, it's almost like Pandora's box, right? Because it hasn't been seen, it's almost pristine because it hasn't been analyzed, it hasn't been criticized, and a lot of people are dead by the time the movie gets seen or are really famous and rich right now. And so it's like this incredible time capsule, like you said. The music lives on, you see it so fresh. It's incredible that you see the origins of so many things. Yeah. That's exactly like you said. Like,
yeah. People should check out Downtown 81 for just...
Oh, yeah. Anytime you can. It's still... I think the reason why it's still so up-to-date or fresh is because it just shows... it shows young creative people in their natural habitat, and they really managed. What was you can't give enough credit to filmmakers, and I think it's because they were all friends that they knew how to shoot this. I mean, Edo Battaglio, photographer. I mean, he did the as far to my knowledge, he was a great photographer, but he only did the camera work on kind of TV Party before this. And it's beautifully shot.
It is beautifully shot. Really, well, it just shows. You know, he had a natural talent for it, and he had the eye. You know, and it just got lucky, you know, that he knew where to point the camera, you know?
Yeah, and those scenes where Basquiat's tagging, and obviously they didn't ask permission, they were just, you know, riding in the streets, and nobody could care less in those days.
No. Like, who was going to...
That's the least of their worries, you know?
Exactly. Again, there was another anecdote where they were saying he was himself a drug addict, so I think at the time, the director
might have had
a drug problem. Yeah, there's some gorgeous, gorgeous shots. It appears they shot at Magic Hour a couple of times, at least in that film, because a lot of it's, of course, shot in the night, too. But
the final scene, I think, and Basquiat goes down the alley beside the Mud Club outside, and Debbie Harry, sort of, she's there, and she's playing this bag lady, and then like, come here closer, give me one kiss, and it's sort of the Divine Comedy again, where Basquiat bends down, gives her a kiss, and she turns into super cute Debbie Harry, obviously. It's like, couldn't have worked better, and she gives him a case of money. And he just gives somebody money and drives off in a car, and he tags on the car on the side Goldwood, which was like one of Basquiat's little sayings. And he drives off, barrels down the West Side Highway, which is now demolished, not there anymore, but towards the World Trade Center, which is also not there anymore.
Right.
So it becomes really, it mirrors that beginning shot where we go through the clouds and we enter this Olymp, this crazy out of time place, and now as he drives out, like you said, Magic Hour, probably sunsetting really low, and he drives out in that car, it becomes so mythical. It becomes really, they were doing at the time, like they were very attuned and aware of what they were doing.
Yeah, and I think it's Ito, is it his only directorial effort?
I don't know. I think so. I think
it's the only one. I think it's the only movie.
Mari Paul, I think she was involved with him for a while, or they were together. She talked mostly about her photographs. I didn't research enough, but it's the only thing definitely that I've seen.
Right. For people who may not know Mari Paul, she was a fashion designer and was she a photographer as well?
She was a photographer. She was really accomplished. She was like doing these incredible Polaroids. And she was responsible for, she had her own boutique downtown, which I think it was called Maripolitan or something, Maripolitan or something. Yeah. And it was like a local hangout. And she shot a lot of the famous Italian designers at the time that came, you know, at the time, Fiorucci and whatever, that it was the Jordache jeans and all this. Very much that downtown. She started to build what we now take for granted.
Downtown chic. Downtown chic.
Exactly.
Yeah, she discovered. She really invented that. She dressed. She was the first one to really style Madonna. She gave Madonna that downtown, that kind of shabby chic, whatever you want to call it. Just giving her all the fake jewelry and, you know, the leather jackets and the ripped fishnets and everything else and the skirts, poodle skirts, whatever they were called. I mean, she kind of really put that together for Madonna, created an iconic look, and she dressed a bunch of people down there. But I think Madonna's probably the biggest name.
Yeah, for sure. And she was involved with Basquiat for a while, and so they all were. So the Glenn O'Brien keeps mentioning he's a really good kisser because he had a lot of practice. Yeah, and when you see him, it's magical. I mean, all those girls, they don't even have to act. When, in the beginning, when he's in the hospital and he sort of gets released from hospital, the girls behind the counter, they're all out there grinning to themselves because he was so – he had such a magic aura. I mean, certainly for somebody – for me, I was in the beginning, I was always like, oh, Basquiat. I saw so many shows as a kid and they came over, these great retrospectives, and it was mind-blowing that he was that young, created that much work, and that consistent, you know, never veering off, and so assured of his own language that now we take for granted as well, because all these people are copying his The Crown, you see a million times, but he references Charlie Parker, which you know, 17-year-old kid does that, you know? He was.
Where did he get it off from, right? I'm looking forward to Sarah Driver's documentary that will kind of probably explain how he got to New York.
Yeah, there was a really good The Radiant Child
was by, I think,
they had a lot of footage.
Yeah, I remember, I think I interviewed the filmmaker, but not for the podcast when that came out.
Tamara Davis.
Yeah, I did, and I remember meeting her, but it's like kills me now. I'm looking back a lot through, because I'm about to do this Kickstarter, so I'm kind of digging out a lot of my old photos and other things to kind of help promote, create a momentum, and finding all these people I talked to, but I wasn't doing a podcast. Yeah. Now that I do the podcast, you know, I wish I got to get some of these people back on. So I'm hoping to get Sarah Driver on, trying to work towards, you know, Jarmusch as a big get. That's, of course, a big get for me.
Oh, wow, yeah.
You know.
That needs to be a three-parter, hopefully, something like that.
Oh, man, if I can get him, I'm going to keep him. I'm going to handcuff myself to him, you know?
Exactly.
I know Downtown 81 is, I know it's on one service here called Fandor.
Okay.
I know people, so if people can see that, they can get, for Americans, I don't know where else Fandor might be on, Canada, and might be in a couple of other countries, I'm not sure. But I know you can get even a two-week trial subscription, and you can watch Downtown 81 right now.
Yeah. They're cool. They always repost my posters. They're really cool and generous. I obviously made a poster way back for Downtown 81, and they use my artwork a lot. So just to promote their own stuff, the side by still, I love that they do that. It's quite generous that they're open to that, you know. And they actually have, like you said, it's really frustrating in Germany because we don't even get film struck over here. I don't know why. It's driving me mad, but it's really hard to. Just to go to the library or to go, you know, we have, unfortunately in Berlin, you get a lot of cool cinemas that screen these movies, but I mean, come on now, Germany, we should finally catch up. There's no real good streaming service for kind of art house films.
That's terrible. It's really, I can see, imagine how frustrating it is, but maybe it's a motivating factor to get you to the U.S. Although, actually, you know, like Downtown 81, for all I know, I'll do all the research before I post like the show, so I can put it in the show description, you know, the show notes, so that way people can find all the things we're talking about. Because it could also be like on Amazon and iTunes, for all I know. I think
they're just releasing a newly restored. I saw a different cover that I hadn't seen before, and I think it's a two disc edition. I don't know who does it. Maybe Arrow. I could be wrong, but it looks like they added some interviews. Obviously, Glenn O'Brien, who passed away.
I think they recently passed away.
Some of those interviews.
Yeah, sadly, it was somebody who I was looking forward to trying to get on the show. So I was very sad to see that he died barely. I think he was still in his 50s.
Yeah. And his art collection, I don't know what happens to it now, but he, of course, has these amazing relics of all these people. Because he was one of the few people who has kept the stuff. You know, a lot of the kids, like, at the time, they weren't aware, you know, they're throwing it out or using it or they're selling it to get something, some drugs or some food or some rent money. But actually, Glenn O'Brien was one of these people that actually collected a lot of. He used to tell the story where he just had, as he was typing, Basquiat was next to him just drawing away on typing paper, and he sort of discarded, threw it out. And when you see his apartment, there's some great photographs of his, and he has like a series of,
can you imagine,
20 Basquiat in a row, beautiful, like experimental drawings. And
I know, yeah, I wonder, like, what now, what didn't, you know, didn't the most recent, didn't the most recent sale, wasn't it like a record-breaking
sale
on the Basquiat? I think it broke the record for most highest priced painting from maybe an American. I don't know.
It's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy with him. It's like one of his sentences that said, all young kings get their heads cut off. And he was very hurt and vulnerable. And actually, I love what Schnabel said about him. Schnabel said, you know, with his tragic death, and he always said he didn't have the tools to circumnavigate the sea of shit, and then everything hurt him. And you see that in his last interviews, the way how he was hurt by the art world, because yes, he was getting money and he was getting great shows, but he was still not.
They
people tried to give the Museum of Modern Art his paintings, and they wouldn't accept them as gifts. Even
they looked at him like he was an anomaly, you know, and a pet, yeah. He wasn't right. He was very wounded. It's really well represented in Schnabel's film. Not so surprising, since Schnabel himself, of course, was there, seeing it all happen. So, but yeah. Basquiat, the movie Basquiat, easily available, I'm sure, on iTunes. Radiant Child, Basquiat, the documentary Basquiat, Radiant Child. I'm not sure where it's at, but again, that's something that we'll figure out how to. I'll figure out how to.
Yeah, it had a good run, because I think and there were giant retrospectives, and they got a lot of the shows actually had the screening room on the side where she was shown, and Tamara Davis gave a lot of interviews and stuff. So it should be easily found. But yeah, I think it's one of those now. He's so ubiquitous, and you know, you're seeing him. All the T-shirts that kids don't even know at Uniqlo, they have like a Basquiat edition, and it of course becomes a little bit hurtful when you see like Sugar Ray Robinson, like a beautiful Basquiat painting on just some kid's thing, and it becomes like the design for a knapsack or something. But that's the nature why Downtown 81 was so special, why that early hip hop, early punk, new wave is so special, because now these things were all commodified and they're all used, and the machine sort of grabbed onto all our little subcultures and sort of made them readily available. And what is lost with that is the authentic, the grit, the layer. And it's also part of the reason why I still, you know, vehemently insist on making the things by hand and drawing it by hand, because I feel there's an invisible quality that gets lost once you apply the computer too much. I mean, of course, it's great to use type and you have layers open and actually make people see it, as I think we said before, that it's great that you can share, you know, your conversations and I can show my art. That's great. But I think you have to remember that this has to come from a really authentic place and a true place. And yeah, those representations on that time in New York is so endless, is such an endless well of fascination and like power to so many generations around the world. I mean, we still plug into it.
It's amazing. I'm glad for the opportunity to talk to you about it. I'm not necessarily sure how many people are aware of just how certain pockets of time in our country have made an impact in various places and around or cultures around the world, you know. But
yeah, obviously after the war, the American culture was so strong, because the most exotic feeling for post-war Germany or in these devastated countries was the cowboy, was Marilyn Monroe, was Elvis Presley. And America had such a prestige, and then post-Vietnam that kind of got muddled and lost. And it's funny that the kids managed to reignite that. It's actually like through the music, obviously, and the great dissidents in their own country, that they were able to criticize what was going on. That had huge impacts. But that exchange, New York just keeps moving, right? Like, you guys are in it. You're taking the subway. Things are changing for the better, for the worse. Neighborhoods are disappearing. But also, you know, you don't get stabbed on the way to school. But for you guys, it's going on. But for us, it's always we measure ourselves after New York. It's always like, oh, Berlin is cool because it's like New York. Or Paris is cool because we have New York. And then post, like, Paris, post, you know, all the surrealists and coming over, fleeing the Nazis, and actually taking New York over, that became the center of art. It's kind of it's amazing that New York has that draw and was able to survive even, I think even now. I mean, I go back and it sort of shifts between the coast now. LA is actually really interesting. I was falling in love with LA because it's so open and weird and kind of destroyed and interesting, kind of neglected and not loved, that you actually for art becomes actually a little bit more interesting. Where in New York, you really have to have some money or know people to actually, you know, find a landing space.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Well, first of all, how do people find you and your work?
I post every day on Tumblr, which is antoniostella.tumblr.com, and that's showing a poster every day. Whether it's from the archive, something I'm working on, or it's just continuously destroyed. I try to maintain it as a sort of challenge to myself. And it's mostly movies I love, but it's also sometimes collaborations and some jobs, that some DVD covers that I do, but that's rare from the certain jobs I get. And then there's Studio T Stella, which is the Twitter, which is my new love, because it's been sort of people are commenting and engaging, and we met through there, and it's really cool that I met all the wrong real guys through there, and it's I like you said, it's humbling because you have people like that trump your knowledge tenfold, and you're like, wow. But it gives you this great trigger every day to find like a spark to work and actually check out movies again that you might have, you know, not neglected and work again. And it's just such a rush to every day wake up to positive comments, whereas, you know, you get one guy in the studio and he's sort of looking at it and saying, yeah, I haven't seen the film. And you're like, oh, yeah. But I bet you somewhere around the world somebody has, and it means something to them that I picked that scene, or, you know, I went for that actor, I choose that color of hue, and it speaks to people. And,
it does.
And that's really sort of cool.
Yeah, because we realize, oh, okay, so that thing that I'm hung up on, there's somebody else that's also hung up on that too. That's pretty cool to know that, you know?
Yeah, and the danger is actually that you don't want to hang out with sort of your little crew anymore, because I want to talk to somebody who also loves Walter Hill, great episode by the way, and also loves The Long Riders, and I want to talk to that person. I don't want to talk to somebody who's like, oh yeah, I know you from 10 years ago, and we sort of rehash our old things over, you know, a drink, but it's actually, I want to nerd out with somebody who's exactly on my wavelength at my mood right now this evening. If you go online, you can actually find those groups. You post an image and right away you get two comments like, oh, I love this film or something, you know. And more often than not, I have now started to make a poster or started something because I realized, oh, there's nobody made a poster for Miami Blues, which is a cool little gem. And there's actually, you look through and you're like, oh, it's actually horrible artwork from the 90s with like flames on top. And you're like, there's no flames in the film. Why did somebody add a flame filter? You know? And so you go back and you watch it and you're like, oh, cool, I love this this film. And so, yeah, that becomes like a really cool playing ground and meeting ground. And obviously, James Hancock, who I think, yeah, you talked to for your Kickstarter, is somebody who's extremely generous and kind of a catalyst in New York to just, he has an incredible workload. He produces for films for Bill Plimpton, who you had on the show.
Yeah, right.
And so he's this, he puts out like 5-6 episodes a week or
something. It's insane. I'm just waiting to give him the green light. Hopefully this is the week. I finally got my pitch. My pitch video was being edited by a friend of mine who's a filmmaker. So he put in all sorts of animation and everything else. So he finally delivered on that yesterday. So now I just have to kind of, you know, post there. I have to, Kickstarter wants to see it first, everything first. So I figure by midweek I should be up and running.
And did you reveal what it is for yet?
Yeah, it's primarily just, it's kind of, well, first of all, I mean, I've been working with really, like, just crap equipment for the longest time. So one of the main points is to really increase the quality just of all my equipment and to kind of create a home studio. That's the least of it, though. But it's also I'm expanding, you know, into officially expanding into new ways and new areas of the film world, so I can, you know, even be more effective in helping certain films and helping the
Awesome! I read the IndieWire. It's really cool that you're getting recognized. I mean, that's really.
What did IndieWire write? Did IndieWire write something?
Yeah, no, it's popping up. I mean, it's popping up in my feed, whatever it comes through. But it's cool to see that once you're connected, you know, you see FilmWax, and it's always on recommended podcasts over here. If you know, there's this new app, I forget what it's called, but it suggests things. So when you go on Wrong Reel, listen to certain episodes, it suggests other filmmakers FilmWax always pops up.
Oh, that's good to know. I'm glad it's popping up. Well, I don't know if you've been able to do so yet, but if you're on iTunes, I don't know, do you have an iTunes account?
Yeah.
Maybe you just write a little something on my page. I know that definitely, and the more people that write reviews or put star ratings in, I know that has definitely will. I got it up to, it's still a tiny number. I've only have like some 70 some people have written reviews, so I really would love to double.
Oh man, everybody put reviews. Yeah, I will definitely give a jungle drum out. But I always try to download it on each device. You know, I have an iPhone, then I have the tablet, and I have the computer, so it's like it gets downloads on each platform.
Yeah, every bit helps. The more people that know about it, help. So that's another aspect of what I'm going to be able to hire people, like occasionally a publicist, or hire a book, somebody to help me book the, so, you know, keep it the way it is. But also I want to get the, you know, we start talking at the beginning a little bit about how you stay motivated and how sometimes you get out of that, you know, you get a little bit maybe less motivated and you kind of have to keep going. You know, you've created this whole archive, and I've created this whole archive, and, you know, it's almost like a momentum. We can't stop. It's beyond our control. It's bigger than we are at the stage. So I feel like I got to keep going. But one thing that kind of refreshed and kind of re-energized, revitalized my motivation was that I started to think about the show in a much more producerly type of way. So I'm always looking for what's the way into the show and not just, yes, a lot of them are, well, the film is coming out on Friday. So let's talk about your film. But the shows that really turn me on and the kinds of conversations that really turn me on are not those, but trying to find really interesting ways of talking to people about particular subjects, you know. And I don't achieve it all the time, but I'm trying to achieve it more frequently, which is kind of like this more thought out way of the types of episodes I want to do. So
no, it definitely comes across as that. I can tell you from the outside. Sometimes it's hard to find it when you're just in it, and I totally know what you mean. Sometimes you get bogged down in vibes, and each day has a different vibe, and you have 2-3 episodes. But when you re-listen, which often isn't enough time, but it definitely comes across as that when you listen from the outside. It's definitely this ongoing thread, as I wanted to say. It's not, you know, episode, and then it kind of cuts off. You could listen to the whole thing in one go because the themes are reoccurring. But it's that great thing that the hierarchies are not there. You know, you have these established people and you have young people coming in, and it's definitely impressive. It's definitely amazing that you get all these voices on.
Well, I got some good ones coming up, so keep listening. Keep listening. Yeah. They got some really good things I'm working on getting, you know, at the moment. So it's fun. It is fun, especially when it works, when I can, you know, successfully get somebody on who I've been chasing after. Yeah.
Yeah, so who are the big ones? Spike Lee and John Rush.
Those are definitely two pillars. I'm inching closer is my point to the – I have a feeling eventually it'll work. You know, it'll work. If it works, it's fine. You know, I know it's not going to necessarily be the easiest interview anyway, so, but Jarmusch, if I should be so lucky where he would agree to come on, I think he'll be there as long as I don't fuck it up. It's mine to succeed with.
I think the same. I think Spike is a little bit more bristly, Jarmusch is definitely, once you show love, he definitely seems like he can vibe on just through even your knowledge of music, because you internalize the movies. Again, you don't need to talk about specific starts or stops. You can just launch into it and happening.
We can talk about anything. And I think with Jarmusch, I definitely would stay contemporary. I'm not going to dwell too much on the past. Of course, things are going to come up and the films are going to come up, but I'm not going to ask him to talk about what it was on the set, you know, not at that length. I mean, if it comes up or if he brings it up, of course, I'm going to explore it. But I think with somebody like Jarmusch, he's very obviously – it's obviously important for him to be still relevant. And so I'm always a little bit careful, cautious about dwelling too much on a filmmaker's past because, you know, then they're it's all about the past and not about what they are doing now or what they want to do in the future. So you want to make the guest feel like they're relevant. You know, you want to contribute to that. So if I bring Jarmusch on, I think he would be, because if he would agree to do it, then I know that he's there and going to be very present and try to be available as possible. And so it would be up to me to obviously elevate the conversation. And that's, it's kind of tricky when you bring on people like that, because they're real smart. They don't suffer fools. They don't have time for bullshit. They're not, you know, so you got to know what you're talking about. So, but I do in these cases. I should be okay, you know.
But I think so, and I think even like a failure in this case would be interesting.
I have a failure for you. Abel Ferrara. I haven't posted it. I talked to him months. I talked to him months ago, and he just. I mean, you know, I pursued him on email. Actually, he was very responsive. His email is available on IMDb. Pro. I mean, so I found it, emailed him, and he got right back to me. And then it was just a couple of weeks or a few weeks till we figured the time out and made it happen. He sent me a few of his films that I hadn't seen, and I had watched a couple of his older films that I caught up with. Like, I was all caught up. I was ready to do it. And then I was like, had him on Skype, and he was like half asleep. He was like, I mean, honestly, I like, oh, come on. And it's a disaster because he's just, he looks like he'd rather be doing anything else. I'm like, why would you agree to do this if you're not going to be present? You know, help me make this succeed, you know? So yeah, that did not come out well. But the thing is this, it's interesting. I don't know if he's coming to New York for the New York Film Festival. He's got a documentary at the New York Film Festival about Rome. You know, he lives in Rome. So if he's coming in, maybe there'll be an opportunity to interview him. And I'd be surprised. He might not even remember doing this with me.
Yeah, so, it often takes two or three starts and stops. I crashed and burned severely on these options. And you wouldn't expect it. I mean, for somebody like Ferrari, you'd be like, oh, yeah. I mean, that must be like pulling teeth getting anything out of him. But if you catch him on a good day, he might be.
It was painful. Yeah. It was just painful because, yeah. Again, I don't know why he agreed to do it then, because maybe he was expecting something else.
It's not on you. It's not on you. Sometimes these people, it's. I get that too. Sometimes it's so rude, and I get really angry at that because exactly like you said, why the fuck? I mean, I'm trying here, and say to me, oh, you know, I'm not feeling it today. I can respect that more, but don't drag me through this. And you see, I'm suffering. Like, what do you want? Like, do I have to shake you awake or punch you? What is it you want? But then you meet the same people. And I've built this huge armor up, right? And then they're super nice. Like you said, you might not even remember. And he's like, it's just yeah, that's the guy.
Well, I should have just. You know, if I had balls, I should have just pushed back again. You know, I should have just said, what's going on? Why can you please, like, wake the fuck up, Abel? Because, you know, then he would have been either really, like, all of a sudden he would have kind of come around, or he would have been offended. And that would have made a great show. So
yeah, but that's not us again. That's not us. I lie awake at night and I think that too. Man, you should have gone up to this guy and said, "What the fuck? Look at mice covered for the samurai. It's 10 times better than this bullshit." But at the end of the day, not us doing that. But yeah, it's nice to fantasize about these things. But I think the enthusiasm and the love is what first, right? And if they don't want it, it's on them. Like you were there, you were present, you were showing it. Like, and you can look back on it and like. I did that. I don't need to. It wasn't me. This guy was just hanging in there.
No, I'm probably gonna. I'll put it together. I mean, it's partly edited already, so I'll probably just finish it and then listen to it again, and I'll probably put it up. Mark Maron, do you know Mark Maron? Do you know WTF?
Yeah, sure.
He put up this disastrous interview he did with Jerry Lewis last year, where Jerry Lewis said after like 20 minutes or something, he just kind of got up and walked out. He goes, "What, are we done?" He goes, "Yeah, we're done."
Yeah.
He didn't know who Mark Maron was, didn't care. He just was so cantankerous and unhelpful a guest. And Maron was doing the best he could. And then at just like a certain time that he had, apparently, that Lewis assumed that, I guess, just was told he had like X amount of time. And, you know, Mark Maron, of course, does, you know, lengthy conversations, of course. So, yeah, Lewis just got up and walked away and
I think, yeah, Maron does, the only thing he does is set it up. He's like, I drove to his house, this was my intention, and this happened. And then you can present it whatever happened. If you snooze,
no, it's true, right. Like, no.
I was there, you know, the guy was hanging there. I mean, I love his films and whatever. I have 10 minutes for you. This is probably, it's really fascinating sometimes to see that, like, because you feel, so many of us can identify with you because we're earnest and we want to, you know, show love or present something. And I always love these conversations because I can identify with it so much. We run from door to door, trying to open a door, trying to close another. And these people that close it, it's like, fuck them in the end. You know, it's like, at least we try. I never want to lose that because you said it's so easy in the beginning to just become like, oh, fuck this guy. And you sit on the train, you stare everybody down, and then it really hurts you. It's like, really, like, after
I know,
a while, it's all on you.
It's pretty painful. I have, like, a conversation with Abel Ferrara. I want to put it out there, you know. I mean, it's like, he is like one of these guys, you know. He's like one of the guys that is the reason.
And you never know how long he's around.
Well, it's not so much that. I mean, it's also like, you know, he's one of the reasons I'm doing this podcast is because people like Abel Ferrara is another, you know, he's like a New York filmmaker from that period where I'm most excited about the people that were making films out of New York in the 70s and 80s, you know. Well, I guess 80s, 90s. It's great talking to you. And
anytime if you can use me to plug in, or you get some things, I've got this endless well of movies and interesting kind of tidbits here and there. And it was great having you had me on. And yeah, we could do anything you want, like more into the actual making of the posters or something, but also anything you have. I'm definitely happy. Let me know if I can help you, man, also promote or put things out there for the thing. I definitely
thank you.
I'll probably, if you, I don't know, whenever you decide to post this or slot it in, but I'll send you, maybe that would be really cool. I've got my Downtown 81 poster. I send you the file.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And maybe you can use that as the header for the show or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I'll figure
it's
out.
It's one of my favorite posters.
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
The Google time. And,
that's a great idea. I could do that. You know, that's a wonderful idea. Yeah, definitely send that. I'd love to have that.
Cool.
Okay, it's been a blast.
Very much so. Thank you, man. And yeah, I'll see you probably through Wrong Reel or online or Twitter.
Yes,
or something.
Absolutely.
And if you're ever in New York, if I'm ever over there, I think I'm back. I might be back in the winter sometime. I'll let you know. I'm there for like hogging some posters or selling something. If it happens, it's gonna be a cool thing. I don't want to
get your show in Brooklyn. That's what we gotta do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have 400 original posters. Actually, not that expensive to put on the show. Yeah. I had one in a small movie theater because you just roll them up. It's really not like a big art drama.
Oh, no.
All you have to do is kind of find like narrow clip frames to hang them, and that's it.
I think it'd be cool. I think we have to try to find a place to really do a show of your work here. You know.
Yeah, or even if you need something, you know, that's what I did with James. You know, I made a poster that was then given away to raise some money for the show.
Oh, right.
You know, it's something.
A small limited number for the as rewards. That would be whatever you can. I don't know. Like, I could definitely use any rewards. I'm still putting that together.
Sure, hit me up. Let me know. I'm definitely up for it anytime. You can use me. Feel free to use it. Cool, man.
Alrighty.
Nice to meet you.
Okay, get some rest. Bye bye.
Find yourself living in a shotgun shack, and you may find yourself.